Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carbonell and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hey guys, this is Justin. In this episode, Jack and I sit down with Mike Green, chief strategist at Simplify ETFs, to discuss the influence of passive flows on the markets, the impact on fundamental and active investing, and the potential risk he sees as more and more investors and flows migrate to passive. In the second half of the discussion, we get Mike's take on the macro landscape, including his views on inflation, high-yield debt, housing, and how he sees things playing out this year and beyond. As always, thank you for listening. Please enjoy this discussion with Simplify's Mike Green. Hi, Mike. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Justin. Thanks for having me.
Wanted to have you back on. Our audience always very much appreciates your insights and thoughts. And so I think where we wanted to start with you is on a topic that we've actually discussed with you in the past, and it's on the rise and the influence of passive investing in the markets. And that's something you've been talking about for a number of years, but it kind of came front and center again recently because David Einhorn, founder of Greenlight Capital, was on with Barry Ritholtz on Masters of Business. And Einhorn basically made the statement that markets were sort of fundamentally broken by passive. And actually, some of the thoughts I think that he had actually came off of a conversation he had with you a few years ago. And so I think that comment, along with how, you know, different people are thinking about that, as well as the fact that the market sort of, I guess, in the last 12 months has been led by maybe a handful of stocks, got us thinking, let's have Mike back on. Let's talk about this stuff. See if your thoughts have evolved or sort of how they've developed over time. Because I don't know, when did you initially start thinking about this concept or idea? Like, how far back does it actually go?
2016, there was a paper written by Lasse Peterson, who's a partner at AQR. Ironically, works with Cliff Asness, who slowly is coming around to the reality of this stuff, but has fought long and hard against it. And he wrote a paper called Sharpening the Arithmetic of Active Management. And that paper challenged the concept of Bill Sharpe's 1991 paper, The Arithmetic of Active Management, which offered the first kind of logical thought process for why passive would outperform, right? What was actually happening. That Bill Sharpe paper was really important because it actually defines passive, what it means to be passive. And he defined passive as an entity that never transacts. They hold every security in the market. Lasse challenged that and said, hey, wait a second, when you rebalance an index, when you change the index, you actually have to transact. And therefore, you can't be passive in that environment. He was 100% correct. But candidly, nobody had really thought to like challenge footnote number 4 in the Bill Sharpe paper and say, are there conditions under which this footnote makes no sense? Reading Lasse's paper for me was one of those eye-opening experiences where it's like, wait a second, I've been thinking about this problem totally wrong. Instead of saying, you know, they are passive, what we actually need to recognize is every day they receive inflows that they need to invest. Therefore, they can't be passive by their own definition. They must be active players. Once you acknowledge that they are active players, then you start thinking about, okay, what are the rules by which they engage in the market? And that is really where that started, was in 2016. I think it was probably the summer of 2016. Ironically, I met, you know, about a month later with Peter Thiel, presented some of this stuff to him, and transitioned over to managing Peter's capital in December of 2016, which positioned me to start thinking about how to deploy these types of strategies. The first thing we recognized was that what we were really describing was systematic strategies. And so we began looking for opportunities in which systematic strategies had become so large that it was apparent to us that the market structure was actually truly broken, as David describes, right? That you were going to see behaviors that you should never have seen before. That's where I stumbled across the XIV dynamics, the inverse VIX ETF, began doing my research and work on that. And fortunately, that trade worked out quite well, where we had recognized that passive or systematic strategies had grown to about 70% of the daily volume of that index, even in a low volatility environment. That created conditions under which in an increased volatility event, something like a 4% decline in the S&P, you are going to see those strategies have to transact at levels that they just could never actually accomplish in the market. and the conditions for a single day move to zero were established. That's when I started working on it. That's when I, you know, first started implementing trades around it. And everything since then has been basically trying to keep track of the changing rules, keep track of the changing asset environment, keep track of the changing players, et cetera. And it's been fascinating to watch, to say the least.
What would you say has been the biggest change, or have your views sort of evolved on this at all? I mean, it's been 7 years, so it's...
I know, it's been a long time, hasn't it? We're going on 8 years, actually, crazily enough. You know, the things that changed the most, so we actually went into the initial decline or the initial withdrawal out of passive was in the fourth quarter of 2018. I'm pretty firmly convinced that the behavior that we saw in the S&P in the fourth quarter of 2018 was actually largely the impact of target date fund strategies and boomer retirements beginning to flow through in the form of required minimum distributions. They then changed the rules around that, right? So they changed the time period in which you would actually start taking those distributions, moving it from 70.5 to 72. Today, there are some conditions under which if you're fortunate enough to die before you've withdrawn all the components, it basically turns into 10 years after your death. So like the rules have changed in terms of trying to keep things in. Ironically, that actually, to me, indicates that many of the players like Vanguard and BlackRock actually know what's going on, and they're desperately lobbying to prevent, you know, the eventual occurrence of these dynamics.
Do you know what percentage passive is of the market? I guess it's hard to figure it out exactly, but like we talked to you, I think, last about this a couple of years ago. I mean, is it risen significantly since then?
Yeah, it's rising close to 3% a year, right? 3 percentage points a year. It's a combination of two things. One is it's just the aging of the population. So when we talk about passive, and my estimate is that passive is about 44% of the market, a little bit more than that maybe, in the U.S. equity markets. That's a combination. That's not the hardest definition. So that's not everybody that needs to transact on a day when they rebalance indices, for example. But it would include things like futures. It would include things like total return swaps. It would include things like commingled investment trusts that you often miss if you just like add up the market share of Vanguard or BlackRock. There's been some academic research that has come into the market in the past couple of years or come into being in the past couple of years, in particular, a piece by, Marco Salmon and Alex Chinko at Harvard Business School, ironically entitled Double What You Think, right? The share of passive in markets is significantly higher. They went through and they actually looked at transaction level data, said what fraction of the market is transacting or being forced to transact around index reconstitution and rebalancing, came to the conclusion that on the hardest definition is between 33 and 38%. And if you extend, in other words, like same day, and if you extend that to a week, it looks like it's somewhere in the low 40s. I think it's slightly higher than that because they're not including things like futures, et cetera, which admittedly are a relatively small component, but still quite significant.
We're going to talk about some of the risks of this in a minute, but is there a level where you like become way more worried about the risks? I mean, we're going up 3% a year. Like, are we there now? Is it something, you know, if we go up another 10%, it becomes way more risky?
Yeah, I mean, there is, because if you think about it, and I've described it this way elsewhere, right? So if you build a model of trading, effectively trading is, for all the advances we've made, it's still something very much like an open outcry system, right? I go into the market, I look for somebody who's going to take the other side of that trade. Right. You can imagine, I've described it also as like you reach your hand into a bag. If you pull out a black marble versus a white marble, a black marble is a discretionary trader who can transact with you. A white marble is a non-discretionary or systematic investor who can't trade unless they are given an instruction by an external third party for some reason whatsoever. Right. Like nothing tied to I'm offering you a higher price. If you replace the discretionary traders with a higher proportion of non-discretionary traders, the market becomes gappier in its construction, right? I need to basically search harder and offer greater incentives to get people to transact with me because there are fewer of them, right? Imagine an open outcry system, right? Take yourself back to, you know, the movie Trading Places, and you have the open outcry, you know, pits or the New York Stock Exchange, where it used to be people shouting at each other. Just imagine you put earplugs in half of their ears. Right. That's effectively what passive is. They're blind and immune to the signals that are coming through the market because they are tied to something external to the market. So when you think about that dynamic, like eventually you get to the point where there's fewer and fewer people that are actually listening and paying attention. And at that point, really catastrophic things can snowball very, very quickly. The problem is that it's almost, it is a little bit of a black box, right? Because it's a stochastic outcome. I can't tell you exactly when people are going to try to make withdrawals, but I can tell you if they try to make withdrawals under conditions under which the majority of the participants are passive, that the implications are far more severe than if the majority of participants are discretionary.
And you've talked about this could work both ways, right? I mean, this could work in an upward direction as well.
It has been working in an upward direction, I would argue, right? I mean, look at the behavior of some of these stocks, right? Supermicro, for example, right? Just the past couple of days is a great illustration of this, where the largest buyer, you know, and the largest holder of the name effectively has no insight into what's actually happening. You know, there's nobody at Vanguard who's looking at Supermicro and saying, you know, with the advent of AI, their rack servers are going to be so much better than everybody else. Or they've partnered with NVIDIA, right? They're completely blind to that. And yet, ironically, when other people try to pursue, you know, the quote unquote opportunity to invest in Supermicro, they reinforce that dynamic as compared to providing liquidity to the market, right? If you or I were big holders of Supermicro and we saw the price of it rise 600% in the matter of days, we'd be like, dude, take some. I'm happy to provide you with some liquidity, right? That prevents an element of that price move that's occurring, right? And actually it creates markets that are more continuous in their construction. But if I'm an index investor, ironically, the next dollar that I receive, simply because somebody's employed and contributing to their 401k, I'm now going to allocate more capital to buying Supermicro with that next dollar because it's become a much larger share of the universe. This is the exact same dynamics that we saw play out with something like GameStop in 2021, whereas the price rose, it became by far the largest player in the Russell 2000. And in fact, if you look at the behavior of the Russell 2000 on a year-to-date basis, I want to say, I can pull up the data in a second, but I want to say it's something like, you know, more than 100% of the recent gains that we've seen in the Russell 2000 are actually tied to the behavior of names like Supermicro. Since January 17th, which is kind of the recent bottom for the Russell 2000, we're at 192, give or take, on the IWM, or 1927 on the Russell 2000. We've picked up 106 points, and of those points, 20% of them have just been Supermicro. Another, you know, like just to put that in perspective, the next largest contributor is MicroStrategy due to the move in Bitcoin, which contributed only 2% of the move, right? So in aggregate, like we're seeing a huge change that's occurred in a lot of these names. And again, this was actually through, what day did I end this? Looks like I actually ran this on the 16th. So this is on Friday, which is actually after Supermicro began to crater, right? So it's even more if I think about the 20% loss that it had on Friday. So that, like, we're seeing these sorts of impacts play through in a manner that I would argue is not dissimilar to what we saw in February of 2021.
It's interesting. One of the things Einhorn references is sort of this vicious cycle, you know, where money comes into passive, it drives up those stocks, value managers underperform, they get redeemed, they have to sell their stocks, that money cycles back into passive, drives those stocks up again. I mean, is that sort of the dynamic we're seeing?
Well, it's absolutely the dynamic. And in fact, there's actually, again, you know, I mean, what's fascinating is that we live in a period in which there's a genuine revolution happening in terms of financial theory and financial thought, where it's suddenly recognized that markets have much greater friction to them than had been previously assumed. This really began with some of the early work of Ralph Coijen, then kind of reached its full form, or what I would describe as you know, the catalyst or breaking point, right? The phase transition with the paper that Ralph and Xavier Gabay published called The Inelastic Market Hypothesis, in which they began to actually document this component of effectively what is generally referred to as demand side analysis. It sounds kind of crazy to say this, but like as economists, we know that supply and demand matters, right? We actually know that that's the case. We can do all sorts of studies around this. But the irony is that we've always assumed that financial markets don't work off of changes in supply and demand, because somewhat by definition, supply and demand are always in balance with price being the determinant. What had never been considered was effectively the non-information dynamics. What's the frictional flow that's created by systematic strategies like passive buying? Because candidly, they hadn't really existed, right? You would give money to a discretionary active manager. That discretionary active manager was theoretically supposed to treat cash as an asset that they could hold. That began to break down as we introduced things like, you know, factors in portfolio construction, where you were looking for managers to simply gain you exposure to the asset class as compared to some form of stock picking genius, right? Now, that may have been a net positive in many people's minds, but when you make those changes, when you suddenly start assuming that the asset class itself has an embedded return that is distinct and separate from the fundamentals or the behavior of the market participants, you're naturally going to change the actual behavior of the market itself. And so, you know, we've seen this play through. People are obviously familiar with things like the efficient market hypothesis. What they're not familiar with, the equivalent of that footnote number 4 in the Bill Sharpe paper, are the assumptions that are embedded in that. The efficient market hypothesis, this idea that people react to news flows, requires a number of conditions for it to hold true, one of which is that markets are highly, highly elastic. In other words, changes in demand, because it's almost always demand, right? Supply is sticky and remains fixed. Changes in demand have very small changes in price in a highly elastic market. In an inelastic market, changes in demand in the presence of relatively fixed supply can cause large changes in prices. These are actually documented differences, right? So the EMH assumes that a dollar into the stock market creates about a dollar of market cap value. And there's some logic behind that, right? If I try to buy, somebody on the other side is trying to sell, the net impact of my addition can't be that great because I'm taking cash from somebody else, right? Just as a thought exercise, every buyer matches with a seller, therefore the cash in the system can't really change. Therefore, it shouldn't have that much of an impact. But it turns out it actually does. And so we didn't have the computing capability to figure this out 50 years ago, 70 years ago, actually. Today, we actually do have the ability to effectively put a, you know, radiocarbon tag onto a trade and follow it through and understand the implications of that transaction. And Gabay and Koijin's estimate is that it's about a dollar into the market creates $5 of market cap. So instead of a dollar in creating a penny of market cap increase, a dollar in creates $5. Now, my work actually takes that a little bit further and says, if I separate out active managers versus passive managers, I get very different numbers in terms of their impact. And mine looks more like $2 of market value created for an active manager and about $17 created for a passive manager. And so when you have passive gaining share, it creates this inflationary dynamic within markets that most have, you know, basically said, oh, it's all the Fed. Right. And so this is one of the challenges that I struggle with is, you know, like, it's very easy to think that there's a deus ex machina in the form of the Fed that controls everything. And they are important. They do affect a lot of things, but they don't really affect pricing in the way that people think. Right. And so I think this is one of these really fascinating situations where it's almost like a, you know, Newtonian world versus an Einstein's, you know, theory of relativity world. Like, they both can't actually be true, even though the approximations of both can be useful up to a point, right? You don't use, you know, quantum mechanics to try to get something to the moon because they're two very large objects, right? You can basically use slide rules and Newtonian physics to calculate the trajectory that's required. But if you want to build a semiconductor, you actually have to start thinking in quantum physics terms because you're dealing with the passage of electrons on very small surfaces. So, you know, this is a perfect example of exactly that. What didn't matter or mattered very little when very few people were following the strategy suddenly matters a lot.
Yeah, what concerns me about this is, you know, at an individual level, it really is a very rational thing to do to invest passively. Like, if you look at the numbers, whatever, 90% of active managers underperform. So each person doing this is being rational, but then them all that adding up, you know, creates a risk to the market. So it's hard to stop it, I think.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. And I think this is actually one of the real challenges that we face is what is, you know, locally optimal, what makes the most sense for Jack Forehand or Justin Carboneau can be caustic and damaging to a much broader population. Everyone acting in their own self-interest is part of the message and part of the signaling in capitalism. But if everybody decided to pollute, right, or if everybody decided to defecate in the streets, we would have to actually step in and say, well, that may be locally optimal for you, but the rest of us are going to get typhus infections if you keep defecating in the streets. So that can't be allowed, right? We see the cities in which that sort of stuff is allowed, places like San Francisco, and they're falling apart. And we know we actually can't enable that type of behavior. It's much harder when you start talking about retirements and investing in stock markets, which don't have the obvious impact, right? It doesn't smell nearly as quickly as, you know, as San Francisco might into those situation, but it's actually far more dangerous.
I want to get your thoughts on what this means for fundamental investing, because my first thought is this is terrible for fundamental investing because passive flows don't care about fundamentals. But Einhorn made an interesting point that, you know, you get to a point where nobody's paying attention, like in certain small cap stocks. And if you don't count on the market to return your capital to you, if you count on the company itself to return your capital, it can actually be good for fundamental investing. Because I think he used the example of like companies trading at a 5 PE, they're buying back their stock or something like that. So how do you think about that?
So I think that's true. Although ironically, that speaks to exactly his point that the markets are broken, right? So the markets are no longer trying to divine that insight. And he's basically saying, look, I now am effectively a hostile participant to the market. I have to figure out how to generate returns without involving the market. I need to have the ability for that to be generated endogenously. Now, ironically, this is actually a good thing because it ultimately means that he and others who follow him will be thinking about the underlying fundamentals and thinking far less about the Ponzi, you know, type dynamics of how can I get somebody else to buy this from me? Right. And that I think is actually really critical. I mean, there were a number of really interesting insights written by a guy by the name of Jesse Livermore, who went by the eponymous name or the anonymous name. I'm sorry, Jesse Livermore, writing under something called the Philosophical Economics blog. And I've been trying to find it. And I for some reason, I can't find it or I haven't found it yet, but I will. He wrote a post. He said, look, you know, how much would you pay for something if you have to hold it forever? Right, if you could never get rid of it. And David is effectively doing that now. He's saying, like, look, I'm going to have to just pretend the market doesn't exist. Occasionally, it'll swing my way. But for the most part, I have to pretend that this thing doesn't exist. And I need to identify things that I would be comfortable holding forever. And that's, there's parts of that that are really positive. The irony is, as he's correctly pointing out, there's very few names that meet that criteria. And ironically, there's a player out there in the form of Vanguard and BlackRock who's taking Americans' dollars and using them to bid up to the most extraordinary degree, you know, companies that are the largest and actually, ironically, don't even need any capital.
It was interesting. When he was talking about that, I was thinking about, like, he's basically evaluating this the way you would evaluate the business down the street. You know, you don't buy the business down the street and be like, I'm going to get multiple expansion. I mean, although you may get that, you're really thinking about, I'm investing this money. How am I going to get my capital back? Like, he's thinking as if there is no stock market almost.
That's exactly right. And that's what he means by stock markets are broken, right? I mean, the idea behind a stock market is that you've got lots of players like David who are effectively making their opinion about what something should be worth. That works great under, again, the rules under which we assumed the efficient market hypothesis was largely correct. In particular, there's a very famous study that was done by Joseph Stiglitz and Sandy Grossman in the early 1980s called the Grossman-Stiglitz paradox that highlights why people are still incentivized to try to find opportunities to invest. And his point, their point was, look, even if markets were efficient, if everybody believed markets were efficient, that would result in overlooking opportunities, exactly as David's describing. The problem with that model is just like that footnote number 4 in Bill Sharpe's paper. There's an assumption within the Grossman-Stiglitz paradox that every player has roughly the same amount of money, right? So, you know, you'll hear people that I don't actually have a lot of respect for, guys like Larry Swedrow or others, talking about things like, you know, the wisdom of crowds and how that works in passive formation. wisdom of crowds actually requires everybody to have the same vote, right? You might be an idiot at picking how many jelly beans are in the jar, and Justin might be an absolute idiot. Jack, no judgment on your inability to forecast jelly beans in a jar. But if I give you 100 votes and Justin one vote, we're going to get a terrible result, even though we quote unquote put it to the crowd, right? The Grossman-Stiglitz paradox assumes that everybody has the same vote or very close to the same vote. In a world in which passive strategies now have 40% or anywhere close to 40% of the voting power, you've actually broken that wisdom of crowds type market. And as a result, you can get really terrible guesses about what stuff is worth.
I want to ask you about some of the pushbacks you get. I actually went on your Twitter before we did this, just to look at some of the things people were saying to you, like in response to this. And you know, one of the things I saw is somebody had sent you like a chart of Google or something and said, basically, here's the stock price performance, here's the earnings growth. You know, that's an example of this really is about fundamentals. Or, you know, people will say, well, Tesla, you know, used to be a much bigger portion of the S&P 500, but it's had bad fundamental results and now it's coming down. So what do you think about arguments like that?
Well, I think in that particular case, I actually responded to it and I just said, look, you know, what you're effectively doing is picking a point in time in which these two lines largely cross. I could pull up the exact same analysis for Apple. It has no resemblance to it. I could pull up the exact same analysis for Microsoft or MicroStrategy or any other company that's out there. And the vast majority of them are going to show something very different. So like, it's just disingenuous to focus on the one that's like, oh, look, it kind of works, right? It doesn't really.
I was thinking about as a factor investor, I was thinking about like how you might use this as a factor. I mean, obviously one thing you do is just buy a market cap weighted index, because I think you've talked about how liquidity does not scale with market cap. But I'm also wondering, like, is there a way to measure this? Like, is there a way to measure? I mean, obviously the market cap part's easy, but the liquidity part's probably a lot harder. Is there a way to like identify the companies that are most likely to be affected by this because their liquidity, you know, is lower as a function of their market cap?
So there's a couple of different ways this can be done. So this is actually drawn from a paper by Valentin Haddad called How Competitive is the Stock Market? And what they're highlighting here is that the larger the market capitalization, the lower the elasticity for the stock. In other words, the larger a company is, the more a change in demand actually causes the price to behave in a more extreme fashion, right? Now, you can think of all the reasons why this occurs, but I'll give you two really simple ones. If I think about the importance of putting Apple into your portfolio, if you want to come anywhere close to the performance of the S&P 500, you have to include it, right? So getting somebody to decide to forego investing in Apple, Microsoft, et cetera, really, really hard. Therefore, they're unwilling to cut it out of their portfolio, even if you offer them an extraordinary price, right? That's just too much risk professionally to take. So that's one way that this impacts it. If I tell you you can't have Delta Airlines in your portfolio, you're like, all right, fine, I'll just put United in there. I don't care. They're kind of the same thing, right? But you can't replace Apple. The second component is actually tied to market microstructure, how market makers work. And so when you think about what a market maker is doing, they're effectively trying to cross the bid and the ask spread in any given stock and do so repeatedly and put that extra money into their pocket. In order to conduct those transactions, they have to put up a certain amount of capital that facilitates them buying and selling, right? And the return on that capital is going to be a function of the size of the bid-ask spread and the quantity of shares that are being traded. Right. So I'm going to put capital up against market making activities as a function of the size of the bid ask and a function of the quantity of shares that are traded. Those are only the one of them. The size of the bid ask is negatively correlated with size typically. And the quantity of shares that gets traded is not necessarily linked to market capitalization. They tend to have higher volumes, but those volumes don't scale in the same manner. Right. So just to put, you know, absolute terms on it, the volume of transaction activity for Apple is somewhere between 5 and 9 times that of Delta Airlines, even though its market cap is literally 100 times larger, right? So those are key differences that play through that explain why we see this phenomenon. But it unfortunately means that market cap weighted indices lead to the types of distortions that we're actually talking about. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So if you were going to run, you almost would just, if you were going to run a strategy based on this to try to take advantage of it, you almost would just run a market cap weighted index rather than trying to figure out like, is this stock going to be more influenced relative to a different stock?
So that is the easiest way that you do it. And then the second question becomes, given that I acknowledge that that is the underlying feature of the market, how do I actually beat the market? And the answer, unfortunately, boils down to you just got to do that with leverage. And so, you know, you've seen players, when you go into periods of relative stability or relative low volatility, and it becomes a unidirectional move, like the easy answer is, okay, fine, I just run with like a beta of 1.5 to some underlying index. That's effectively the secret of Cathie Wood over the, you know, a period of time, was that her beta was significantly higher than the market, even as her alpha was actually quite negative.
Have you given any thought to this on a corporate governance level? I'm just thinking, like, if you have, you know, I know Vanguard and BlackRock, they have divisions in the company that, you know, are trying to look at shareholder-friendly policies and practices and how companies are structured. But I'm just thinking that, you know, if more and more money continues to go passive, you know, how that shakes out from a governance perspective. And are we just going to be walking around with, like, companies with managements that can kind of do anything because there's really no oversight, kind of?
So it's, I think there's certainly an element of that. A lot of people have highlighted this dynamic, in particular, John Coates at Harvard Law School has written a fantastic paper called The Power of 12 that evaluates these types of characteristics in the context of private equity and index investing. I think I agree with a lot of his conclusions that this is a much bigger deal. This dynamic of consolidation and control is something you need to be much more concerned about in private equity or even venture or very large corporations as compared to index investing per se. Like, look, I think that the players that are involved here, the Vanguards and BlackRocks, are more venal than we want to acknowledge. But I also don't think their objective is, you know, to twirl their handlebar mustaches and rub their hands together with glee as they imagine controlling, you know, the economic outcomes of the United States of America. I just don't think that's actually happening. But I do think that we need to acknowledge that these entities are in many situations willfully ignoring components of what we're describing. Right. So the voting part, I think there's actually relatively easy solutions to, particularly on the public side. The market structure impact, the price dynamics, the impact on capital formation, that's the part that I think that people are not paying attention to.
For the second half here, I wanted to switch and talk about macro. It seems like a pretty, especially for like macro tourists like myself, it's been a pretty challenging environment to figure out. I mean, it seems like the market is pricing in a soft landing type scenario. You know, there's a lot of higher for longer type people on Twitter, but then there's some other people who think, you know, the Fed's way too tight here and we've got a pretty significant recession coming our way. And I'm just wondering if you could talk overall about how you're thinking through the macro landscape right now.
Well, I think there's a legitimate reason for all the conversation, right? One is the quality of the data that we're receiving in the macro world is far worse than we've seen historically. That's not because the BLS has, quote unquote, gotten worse at job reports, for example. It's simply that the volatility and uncertainty and things like participation rates in surveys has collapsed, right? Things like the job opening and labor turnover survey, which regularly had participation rates in the 70s prior to the pandemic, is currently printing participation rates in the 30s. The way that you behave, 30% of survey recipients actually respond with the data, right? The way that you conduct an analysis of that is very different if it's 30% response rates than if it's 70% response rates. And I'll give a really simple example of how that can have a very meaningful impact. So the way the BLS actually assumes that the market works is if you don't respond, then you likely had the exact same behavior in terms of hiring, firing, et cetera, that you would have if you had responded. So they effectively just extend the universe of responses, right? I think that's a very bad assumption in an environment in which you're only getting 30% response rates, because a 30% response rate is likely going to miss all the people who are really struggling in their businesses and just don't feel like they have the time or the obligation to continue to respond to these things, right? Work from home has meaningfully changed response rates, right? If I'm sitting in the office and my boss pops his head and says, hey, what are you doing? It's like, I'm responding to this thing from the BLS, right? If I'm sitting at home, is my boss going to pop his head in and say, you know, what are you doing? Probably not nearly as much, right? Like nor do they necessarily, and a lot of these surveys are conducted by telephone, right? How do I reach the person? It's just a lot harder to actually do these things, right? If you call the front desk at a business where everybody is operating and you say, hey, can you put me in touch with the person who's in charge of hiring? It's a lot easier if they're physically co-located in the same place and if they're spread out across, you know, multiple individual homes. So I just think we're making some bad choices. And then I think that extends in terms of the interpretation of the data. And then it extends further in terms of people basically trying to explain the narrative, right? So I can turn around and try to explain the narrative and what we're seeing in markets by saying, look, there's an entity, we'll call them Vanguard or BlackRock or just passive investing in general. Let's not pick on an individual company. And let's actually turn around and say, they're not pricing anything in, right? So you say markets are pricing in X. I actually think the irony is that increasingly we're moving to an environment to which markets are not pricing things in. To explain what I mean by that can take me 30 minutes, right? It's just much easier for me to say, oh, markets are pricing in a soft landing. Like, we all get that. That's very easy, right? It implies that, you know, there's some logic to this, right? Why is this happening? If I try to explain to you, no, I actually think that we're largely captured by entities that I think the technical term is don't care anymore, right? That's just a much harder conversation. And it's really a difficult one for a lot of people to accept.
But in terms of the inflation data, do you think the real level of inflation in the economy is lower than what we're getting reported?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I really do. And I would highlight that, you know, the areas that we saw a large impact, right? We've done all sorts of crazy things to try to isolate different impacts. So we know, for example, that housing is corrupted by the slow moving nature of things like owner's equivalent rent and the way the BLS captures rents. It uses a rotating panel of rents to effectively say, what is everybody experiencing? And so if my rent went up 3% year over year, and that decision is already happening, I want to be able to capture a component of that so that I can actually understand what you know, the average experience is. But that's a very different statement than what the marginal experience is. What's the transaction that's happening today? I'm effectively capturing a bunch of information that happened 15 months ago in the BLS calculation. If I look at the stuff that's coming through that's happening now, what's called new tenant indices, for example, those are actually printing strongly negative numbers. They're printing numbers that are more negative than what we actually saw during the global financial crisis. And I will tell you, as somebody who is actually currently looking for housing, this is very much what I'm experiencing if I look at rents. The very low supply of houses available for sale, in part because of mortgage dynamics that people have heard about endlessly, in part tied to more people aging in place than we had originally anticipated. The baby boomers are more unwilling to sell their homes than they might have been. The increased incidence of younger people living at home with their parents, for example, is contributing to people aging in place and staying in a home so that they can provide services to their children. These are all things that are changing the character of the data that we're receiving, but it's particularly influencing the buying area, right? The ownership, the home ownership area. You know, that data is being missed, right? I would just turn around and continue to say, how you interpret the data that's coming through really matters. I'll give you an example of something I'm actually working on right now. So one of the things that you'll hear people talk about is the incredible improvement in the balance sheets of the bottom 50th percentile, right? At the same time, when you talk to people, they'll tell you, my finances, you know, if you talk to somebody who's in the bottom quartile, for example, they will tell you, I'm at the breaking point, right? I don't have any money in savings. My car payment's going up. My insurance bill is going up. The food prices are not coming back down. I'm not making that much more money associated with it, et cetera. And so, you know, costs of childcare have exploded. My child is not attending school with the same frequency because they've been taught by COVID that going to school isn't mandatory. And so you're seeing rising rates of truancy, et cetera. These are all stresses that are being felt by young and lower income earners in particular. And yet, paradoxically, we're seeing this fantastic improvement in their balance sheets, which is totally against what they're actually telling us in survey data, right? What's actually happening is fascinating. When somebody retires, what happens to their income?
It goes down.
It goes down. And so when you have a surge of boomers retiring, What we're actually seeing is that bottom half of the economy is suddenly increasingly composed of retired people who have strong balance sheets, but no earnings. And so we're showing this as this improvement in balance sheets. Meanwhile, people who are actually still trapped in this segment are like, I have no idea what they're talking about, right? This is like, you know, I feel like these people are gaslighting me, which is exactly the social behavior that you would expect, right? Because you, this is the equivalent of like somebody coming to you and saying, oh, I totally understand your position. But, you know, Jack, if you had just bought Bitcoin, you'd be so well off that you wouldn't have to worry about anything. So let's focus on Bitcoin instead of like paying your bills this month. And you're like, dude, that doesn't solve my problem. What are you talking about? And, it, you know, it's this really weird thing where people are like, oh, no, your balance sheet is really strong. You've got better savings than you used to have. And they're looking at their savings going, I have no idea what you're talking about. So, you know, that would be a really good example of how data shifts and how data is changing in a way that I would argue, you know, matters, but is because it's never happened before, it falls into the sort of Greenspan, you know, there's a flaw in my model of the world that, you know, only arises after the countervailing facts show something totally different.
So would it be fair to say that you think the risk of recession is higher than what the market thinks and higher than what most people think right now?
I think the key risk that we're creating is the risk of a much more rapid deceleration. And I'll give another simple example of that. If you listen to Uber and Lyft's last earnings calls, they both highlighted an important feature that's occurring: increased driver availability. Right now, what does that actually mean? Does that mean drivers are working more hours in the day? No, it means there's more people driving for Uber. Why would there be more people driving for Uber? Because that's now become the unemployment benefit. That's how you make ends meet, right? You have a car, you got an asset, you can make significantly more money driving for Uber or for Lyft, particularly if you're utilizing an asset that is otherwise underutilized, right? You can make a lot more money, at least in cash income, than you can from going onto unemployment. And so we're effectively seeing the private sector unemployment rolls expand, even as the government is saying, I'm seeing no increase in claims, right? That means the policy response that should be coming, people saying, wait, the economy is actually slowing and becoming more fragile, is not getting the response that you would expect. And I'll just give you, like, let's just play that game through for a second, right? I lose my job, I start driving for Uber. That's great. Yes, I modestly lower Uber drivers' earnings. It improves the profitability of Uber because there's greater availability, there's greater utilization, people are more willing to do this, there's less surge pricing, right? The Uber environment improves. Now the next person loses their job, or the next 2-3% of people lose their job, and suddenly they can't be absorbed into the Uber universe, and at the same time they stop using Uber, right? So it creates the potential for a very brittle and fragile rapid deceleration that is unlike anything we've seen for a very long time.
So given these dynamics, I mean, do you think it's fair to say the Fed is way too tight right now?
I think the Fed is way too tight right now. And I think, you know, part of the irony is that we, you know, if you think about the narratives that exist, right, it's why are stock markets at high? Well, because financial conditions are loose. What's the definition of financial conditions? Stock markets at highs. Right. Well, congratulations. You now got a circular definition, right? You know, if I define financial conditions by credit spread tightness and by markets relative to their averages or a level of implied volatility, then it's actually just a tautology, right? Why are markets high? Because financial conditions are loose. What's your proof for that? Well, markets are at highs. That's just not what we're actually seeing. What we're actually seeing is a total unwillingness for people to transact in manners that requires them to change the existing debt contracts, whether that's happening at the corporate sector with the increased, you know, basically game of Russian roulette that is being played by companies that are refusing to refinance, because if they refinance, they're actually going to be in a situation in which they basically are, you know, entering a debt spiral. They've increased their coupon payments so much, they no longer are able to actually run their businesses they would like to. That causes things to deteriorate much more rapidly. So they hold off on it, effectively hoping that the Fed is going to cut rates. Same thing is happening to individuals who own homes, right? What are they desperately trying to do? They're desperately trying to hold on to that really cheap mortgage because that allows them to do all sorts of other interesting things, like rent their house out and turn it into a cash flow positive property, right? But if they lose their job or if other people lose their jobs and you start to see vacancy rates rise, then again, that spiral begins, right? And it becomes a very dangerous situation that I would argue is breeding an incredible level of complacency in markets and policymakers right now.
See, if you're right, it's going to be another example of the Fed just waiting too long to move. And I thought what Powell said in December about, you know, now they've had to walk it back, but he was kind of saying, you know, if we wait until they see all the data they need to see, it's going to be too late.
Yes.
So he was kind of getting in front of that from a trend standpoint. And, you know, now here they are walking it back again. So that's interesting.
I think this is one of the real challenges, right? Because again, we've defined financial conditions. How do we know loose financial conditions? Markets are at highs. Well, if my theories are correct, and again, they're my theories, and yes, there's growing academic evidence for them, and individuals like David, who's far smarter than I'll ever be on this stuff, is certainly validating, and it's helpful to hear that he's incorporated components of this. But notice in my discussion, I didn't say anything about the Fed when I was talking about Vanguard or BlackRock, et cetera. I do think they're important. I do think they influence things, but I don't think they influence things in the way that people think.
Let's talk about the way that you would position or build a multi-asset class portfolio, a strategy for the type of environment that you think we're in.
Well, I think there's two ways that you can do this. And candidly, I have not done the job that I had hoped to do in this in some situations. In particular, I'm extremely sensitive to this issue of flows and the origination of flows tied to employment characteristics. Because what I know is we have outflows associated with retiring baby boomers that are tied to asset levels, whereas contributions are always going to be a function of incomes. My expectation was that we would have a larger response to the increase in interest rates that we've seen. I candidly have been wrong about that, in part because people have not refinanced their debt. And you can see this if you look at things like the maturity wall for high yield. I'll actually just pull up the chart here quickly so you can see that. So this is actually showing something slightly different, but it's a fascinating, fascinating chart when you actually think about what's going on here. So this is the years to maturity for the high yield benchmark. What used to be an asset class that you would issue new paper anywhere from 7 to 10 years in length, that slowly tightened up and shortened up as people became more comfortable with high yield and your ability to continually refinance it. You can see how that has fallen over time. This was the lead in to the global financial crisis, this very accelerated decline. By the way, this was the lead in to the dot-com cycle, the cable television credit collapse that occurred. WorldCom is happening out here, for example. But here's the lead into the global financial crisis. As interest rates began to rise, people were unable to refinance. They were then forced to refinance by a combination of maturity components. This is where we are today. We are less than 5 years of maturity for the index in total. And it's fallen at a pace of basically a year. In other words, nobody is issuing high yield paper. That means that the system becomes increasingly fragile because a sizable fraction of the loans that were entered into in 2020, for example, are now in year four. If they happen to be 5 or 6 years in maturity, if you allow those credits to actually get within 12 months of maturity, they suddenly become current liabilities. And that has a dramatic impact on your credit rating, meaning that a lot of these companies are basically at a point where they have to refinance. They can't afford, most of these companies have neglected to do this or tried to avoid doing this because they're desperately trying not to face the dramatically increased coupon costs. Ironically, that actually is made even worse by changes in the Trump tax reform in 2017 that limit the tax deductibility of some levels of interest expense. And so many, many of these companies are actually now looking at their increase in interest expense associated with refinancing, creating conditions under which they can no longer deduct that interest against their taxes, their after-tax cost of capital goes up a lot. That puts them at a competitive disadvantage. It makes, theoretically, the value of these companies should fall very rapidly under those conditions. But again, like, because nobody is issuing new paper right now, what are you going to do? You're going to go out and be like, I'm going to bet that the market is absolutely collapsing, even as there's no demand or nobody's asking me to buy new paper, right? So if I'm a credit fund, all I can do is go out and buy their old paper, right? As I do that and I put more and more money into the old paper, it causes credit spreads to collapse and compress and convinces everybody that financial conditions are loose, even as nobody can actually access capital.
So just tease that out a little bit more in the context of constructing a portfolio and positioning a little bit.
So what I would suggest is that we're actually trapped in a situation that Chuck Prince described so well. As the music's still playing, you got to dance, right? You have to remain invested. You have to remain exposed to risk assets and equity markets, even as you fully acknowledge that there is an impending event that's going to show up as a significant credit cycle that you can't possibly price until the event actually happens, right? It's a little bit like the COVID dynamics. Anyone who was paying attention knew about COVID in January. The markets tried to correct. They then went right back in everybody's face. And as you got to the end of February, everyone was sitting there like, oh, maybe it's not a big deal that we're shutting down the world, right? Like, I'm watching China and I'm seeing people wandering around like zombies and collapsing in the streets. Or I look at Italy and, theoretically their entire elderly population is currently being annihilated because the hospitals are overrun. It feels like that should be a big deal, but it just wasn't until it was, right? And then everything happens. I just think you're facing something similarly. So I think you're kind of trapped. I would suggest that one of the opportunities that exists in this very low environment is to enter into truly convex positions. So equity options as compared to be going long equity options on the S&P or even on the NASDAQ is a better expression than being outright long. Right? It just gives you somewhat of a convex payout. If you want to flip that in reverse, do the opposite, right? Be long the individual, but go buy protection, right? But nobody wants to do that right now because that means your portfolio lags, which means you get fired, which means, well, what was the point, right? That's really what Chuck Prince was saying when he's saying, when the music's playing, you got to dance, right? It's all well and good to say that to lean back against the wall of the party and be like, oh, look at those idiots. They're dancing. Don't they know that they're going to stop that music? There aren't going to be enough chairs, so you should just be sitting down. Well, you can't play the game then, right? You get kicked out. So, that's the challenge that we face right now.
Do you see, I just remember last time we talked to you, you saw a pretty good opportunity in short-term bonds, I believe. Do you still think there's an opportunity there?
So I do, but I think it's more challenging than it was when we were north of 5%, right, in the very short-term paper. The rally that happened in the fourth quarter of last year led me to put on positions that effectively faded the idea of 7 rate cuts from the Fed. I reduced some of my duration. I've now started to put those back on. And so I do think that the opportunity exists. But I just think it's really important for people to recognize that, like, fixed income, if the Fed were to panic and decide that, oh, my gosh, this is much worse than we think, we have to respond, could rally very sharply. I think that's going to, exactly as we're discussing, like, I think the Fed is going to be slower to move. I think the Fed is going to be less willing to be perceived as soft on inflation because we had this inflationary episode, right? It just makes it harder. Ironically, and I wrote about this, a couple of years ago, I think what people are missing about that is that when the Fed hikes this aggressively or when the ECB hikes this aggressively, ironically, the most likely outcome is you take capacity out of the system, exacerbating the supply disruptions that we've already seen.
Mike, let's end on this. So thinking 5 years and beyond, what has you the most worried and what has you the most optimistic?
Well, what I'm most worried about is the dynamics around passive investing. I think it's really frightening that as Americans, we have outsourced our retirement to the market. That's not what markets are supposed to do. Markets are not supposed to deliver a return to individuals that allows them to be supported into their old age. It can be part of the solution, right? I can choose to allocate capital into the public equities as a component of my portfolio, But this somewhat ridiculous idea that I should just, you know, mechanically put money into quote unquote stocks for the long run, to steal from one of my former professors, Jeremy Siegel, and that I should get returns delivered to me that allow me to achieve those objectives is, to me, very fundamentally flawed, right? I've increasingly started stealing a term from, Web 2.0. If you're not putting in the work and you're not paying for the product, you are the product, right? So when Vanguard is offering you a 3 basis point index fund and encouraging you to put your money aside on a continuous basis, they certainly may think that they're working in your best interest. If everybody does it at the same time and everybody does it together, it creates systemic risks that hadn't existed before. And the second part that I would just highlight is that those companies are not making their money off of the, you know, 3 basis point management fee. They're making their money off of things like securities lending operations, et cetera, that they can cover the costs associated with, which includes executive salaries and everything else.
Gotta leave us an optimistic one, though.
Okay, now I gotta leave you the optimistic one. So listen, I think that we are finally starting to address, you know, I would argue that this idea of the fourth turning, while I don't actually love the terminology and I don't love the description of it as deterministic, right? Because if everybody just kind of throws up their hands and they say, oh, it's just the fourth turning, this is what happens, right? Well, then you're never making the hard decisions that get you out of the fourth turning, right? You're never making the hard choices that actually allow you to accomplish an objective. But I would argue you're starting to see this change. So, you know, very significant blunders that we made over the past 50 years that we were largely able to escape the consequences of, things like a failure to invest in our energy infrastructure, or the demotion of nuclear power as a long-term solution to the unbelievable needs for energy that we'll all have going forward. I think those are starting to break. I'm seeing the same thing, by the way, around the discussion around passive. Ironically, those who are the most aggressive proponents of passive have now retreated from, oh, that's just crazy, it can't be impacting it, we know that they're just buying in proportion to the market cap. Increasingly, they're starting to say, well, yes, we know that it impacts the behavior of the market. But the question is the cost of that, this is them speaking, is the cost of that worth the, you know, savings that Americans experience in terms of reduced asset management fees? I think the answer is no. They think the answer is yes, but everything I'm seeing in discussions with them suggests the reason that they believe that to be true is because while they will acknowledge the passive is influencing the market, they don't think that it's really that big of a deal. I think it's a really big deal. I think the implications of it are going to be sizable. And unfortunately, I think the evidence is moving in my direction. But it's far from universal at this point. So I think there's progress in those discussions around hard choices and a recognition that we're going to have to make some changes. Unfortunately, I think it's probably going to be a crisis that causes that to emerge. But the great irony of all of this, right, is none of that really matters. The resources of society are not changed by the pricing of those resources on a public market. Apple doesn't become a genuinely less valuable company. It becomes a less market-priced company if the price of it falls. It doesn't lose much of its moat, et cetera. I don't think that's entirely true, so I'm you know, hesitating as I say it. But as a society, like, we can decide to look past this and decide that we're going to behave very differently than the pure market price action would suggest. If we don't, then there's going to be much more severe consequences.
Thank you very much, Mike. Always super thoughtful. Appreciate having you on and sharing your wisdom with our audience.
Absolutely a pleasure, Justin. I appreciate you and Jack having me on.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at @JJCarboneau. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.